You're listening to another life-transforming message from C3 Church San Diego. For more information on our church, go to c3sandiego.com.
I appreciate your welcome and your love. I have been among C3 Tribe for the last couple of years, off and on, because Phil and I go back a long way, probably 20-odd years. And so I've known Phil much longer than I've been amongst the C3 churches, and I've had a lot of fun amongst the C3 tribe in recent couple of years, and of course looking forward to speaking at the conference in Sydney next year, the Presence Conference. So thank you for your love and your welcome, because Pastor Jürgen, I've only known probably for the last year or so, met him in different spots around the world like we guys do, bumping into each other as we're ministering around the world, and often don't know who else is going to be showing up. And love him to bits, and he's a great guy. You all know that. My wife Glenda is traveling with me, and we've been married for 44 years this year. We have a home in Scottsdale, Phoenix, Arizona, where we escaped from the grandkids. I'll just tell you the truth, because 8 grandkids is out of control. Someone should be in jail or something. To just do that and think it's okay. It's not. Stop it. So we're escaping them here. Although we have 2 of our grandkids with us in our home in Scottsdale. They're the worst 2 to have with you, because they're called Jonah and Sienna. I call them Bonnie and Clyde. Because at 7 and 4, they're already showing signs of being outstanding criminals when they get older. The best I can forecast their future at the moment. I know. Well, I hate to try and sell you things on our first date. I know. Because our dates are few and far between, I'm fast-tracking our relationship, okay? To the point at which I sell you things, which is only our 3rd date anyway, so I'm fast-tracking you a little bit, but not a lot. This is about and for teenagers, parents of teenagers. I think these teenagers are the most underestimated generation in the world, especially in the Western world. If you Google teenagers and, don't put a 3rd word in, let Google give you what it thinks you're looking for, nothing good comes up. The 3rd word is teenagers and drugs, teenagers and crime, teenagers and alcohol, teenagers and pregnancy, nothing good comes up. We want to change that. And it's a lot of work for us to do that. I don't know that we'll see that changed in our generation, but generationally we can shift that if we invest in our kids. So this is for and about teenagers. This white one, one of our best sellers, called Heaven Is My Home. I did this because as a pastor for 30 odd years, I was surprised, maybe I shouldn't have been, at how many people were afraid of dying or concerned about a loved one that had died, that they knew had gone to heaven. But that didn't really mean much to them, because heaven as a subject has been hijacked by mystics and theologians, really, for generations. And we, the ordinary people, have what they tell us, which is not a very practical, down-to-earth version of heaven. This asks and answers questions about heaven, like, is heaven a physical place? And how old will we be in heaven? Will there be kids in heaven? Will we look the same in heaven? Will there be animals in heaven? Will the animals in heaven be able to talk? Better hope, in case your dog has something to say, how badly you treated it when you kicked it last week. Will there be extinct species in heaven? Will we have privacy? Will we disagree and argue in heaven? Will we attend ball games and pop concerts and so on and so on? I tell you, I wasn't smoking a joint when I did this teach, okay? In case you're thinking, what in the world? Who are these people? This is very practical, very biblical based. This is going to make you want to go to heaven, not before your time, but it's going to make heaven much more real to you, or someone you maybe know that would be helped by that right now. This blue one is called Live Full, Die Empty, because I think the idea is that we're supposed to get full, but keep getting empty. We don't want to die with this secret recipe of stuff we wish we'd told someone. This whole thing operates like 2 stores. If Earth is Target, and heaven is Neiman Marcus, you can't spend your voucher for Target in Neiman Marcus, or vice versa. So you can't store up what you're supposed to get rid of here and think, I'll use it in heaven. There's nobody in heaven needs it. Nobody there needs help or healing or deliverance. So you, no poor need feeding there. No naked need clothing. No one needs rescuing. So you've got to get empty. And God is not drawn to full things. God is drawn to empty things, emptiness. So if you stop finding empty people, I'll tell you, God will check out. He loses interest in us. So you got to keep finding empty people, empty spaces for God to fill. So that's live full, die empty. Wisdom for Life is a book of Proverbs, really. I suppose I recorded audios, about 50 or 60, 5 to 8 minute audios, what I call Wisdom for Life stuff. Stuff I wish someone had told me. What would you say to a younger version of you is on there. Good question to ask yourself. What would you go give yourself a heads up about if you could go back 20, 30 years? Just stuff about aging well, handling finances, building teams, growing as a person. Just things I wish someone had told me, because this will make you less narrow. It will make you less threatened by people different to you. And God knows the church needs a good dose of that. So stuff like that. And then Events Versus Process, one of my books that are here. I've written 7 books. And this is Events Versus Process, because I think we exaggerate events and we underestimate the power of process. And especially in charismatic churches where we think everything can be fixed in the prayer line, it can't. So Events Versus Process. All right, everybody glad the commercials are over? Say amen. Well, the title of this message I'm going to spend some time with you on for 30 minutes or so is called The Centurion Factor. I have a graphic here to help you memorize that better. The Centurion Factor. We're going to read about this encounter Jesus had with this centurion who had a sick servant. And I'm going to explain to you what I mean by the factor, the ingredient, the element that he brings to the table then and today. I think what he brought to the table that day has been hugely hidden, misunderstood, not fully appreciated. And I want to try and rectify that a little bit today, because the Bible says that what happened that we're about to read amazed Jesus. Whatever amazes God is worth some scrutiny, because God, I promise you, is not often amazed. When you are omniscient and omnipotent, you're hard to impress. Seriously. So for the Bible to record that Jesus was amazed is probably worthy of closer attention than flicking the page to the next passage. So I'm going to put you on pause a little bit this morning as we consider what it was that amazed him, that I hope will amaze us this morning as we leave the service. So Luke 7, verse 1 to 10, Jesus entered Capernaum. And there a centurion's servant, whom his master valued highly, was sick and about to die. The centurion heard about Jesus and sent some elders of the Jews to him, asking him to come and heal his servant. When they came to Jesus, they pleaded earnestly with him, "This man deserves you to have you do this for him. He loves our nation, and he has built our synagogue." So Jesus went with them. He was on his way to the house when the centurion sent friends to say, "Lord, don't trouble yourself, for I do not deserve to have you come under my roof. This is why I did not even consider myself worthy to come to you. But say the word, and my servant will be healed. For I myself am a man under authority, with soldiers under me. I say to this one, go, and he goes, and that one, come, and he comes. And I say to my servant, do this, and he does it." When Jesus heard this, he was amazed at him. Turning to the crowd following him, he said, "I have not found such great faith, even in Israel, even amongst the team, even amongst the apostles that spent 24/7 with him. Even amongst them, he has not found such great faith as he encountered that day." Then the men who had been sent returned to the house to find the servant well. So this is an interesting set of things going on here. We have a complete outsider to the church. We have someone that would not be welcomed in any church in San Diego today, or they would certainly feel that if they woke up today and thought, "I'll go to church." I think they would think twice and think no. I think the church would be embarrassed and find it awkward if I rocked up, because he is a high-profile outsider, as far as the Jews were concerned. He's not only a Gentile, he is also a Roman, not just a Roman. He is high up in the Roman military command as a centurion. So he is part of the system that the church perceives is completely against them. He is part of the persecution crowd that are against them. And so this guy already has the odds stacked against him for a miracle. We read in this passage that somehow he had built a close relationship with the pastors, with the elders, as it were, of the local church, the local synagogue. This would be our equivalent language now. He has a problem that despite his finances, his position, his contacts, no doubt, and his influence, he couldn't fix, which was he had a staff member that was very sick, clearly with some kind of terminal illness and getting worse and close to death. The Bible subheads this story, the centurion's servant, but as we just read, that's the least of whom this story is about. So it's not about the centurion's servant at all. If it was, we would certainly know whether the servant was male or female, whether the servant was, what kind of sickness the servant had, how long had the servant been in the centurion's employment, why this servant matters so much to him. We'd certainly know more about the moment of the miracle. We may know something about the days afterwards of the recovery, because all of that and more details we get about other people that Jesus helped. The Bible translators thought to call this the centurion's servant. But as we read the story, the miracle that happened is almost like a postscript on the end. It's kind of a non-event is the miracle. Because the bigger miracle here is going on in this encounter between Jesus and these elders and the centurion's household that came to him. So he approaches, the centurion approaches these elders of the synagogue because he knows through them about Jesus. And he asks them to ask Jesus, would they appeal to him to come and heal his servant? The elders approach Jesus and say, hey, this guy really deserves your help because he's a good guy. Though he's a Roman and would be normally an outsider, in our stereotyping of these people, he's not one of those. He loves the church. He loves what we are doing, so much so he even financed the building of our recent synagogue. So this guy had put huge finances, apart from huge relational resources, into the church. And the elders had hugely benefited from a relationship that I suppose others would have been very threatened by and disapproving of them having. They understood a massive principle that much of the church in the world, by the way, still don't understand, which is that our resources are in our relationships. If you build a life rich in relationship, you'll never be short of stuff. If you try to build a life rich in resources and bypass relationship, you will constantly plateau in your life. Because there's always something you need, and whatever you need, even if it's a phone number of someone that can help you, or a name that you don't know about, that's the very person you need, someone always has or knows something you need. And if we do not build a life that has a large circle of inclusion, then you will be limited to the few relationships you have, therefore limited to what they have. So these elders built relationships much wider than what most church people would have done and hugely benefited from it, not just relationally, what enriched, but financially too. So Jesus hears this appeal and sets off, as we just read, in the direction of the centurion's home to go and do what he always did, which was to go and lay hands on this servant and heal this servant. Whilst Jesus is on his way behind the scenes, the centurion clearly is reconsidering what he's set in motion. He's said to himself, I don't want Jesus to come to my house. I should never have asked him to do that in the first place. What I'm going to do is I'm going to send another delegation of some of my staff and say to him, you know what, Jesus, I don't want to waste your time. I'm even embarrassed to have someone like you in my home. Maybe it would be uncomfortable for you too to be in my home because I'm very unpopular in the community amongst your people generally. So you know what? I was thinking about how authority works, I think is what he must have been thinking. And he said, you know what, I have servants and I tell them to do stuff and they do it, and I send them and they go and do a thing. He said, I think maybe you could just send your word instead of coming yourself. Send your word like I send a person, a staff member, an employee. And in his mind, he's likening a person to Jesus's word and thinks, well, his words are his servants, as are all our words. Our words are our servants or are our masters. So in his mind, he takes that analogy of how authority works, transfers it to Jesus and how he must do things, and then offers this suggestion to Jesus. I think the centurion that lived in a world of Roman seals, he lived in a world where he would receive instructions either from military or from government above him. In that letter, there would be certain requirements. Some of them would be small and insignificant. Some of them would be huge in terms of policy or military adjustments they were making in the way that they did what they did. And of course, the person that sent the letter could be many, many miles away. But he knew that the seal on the letter of the person that wrote it was as good as the presence of the person. So I think he'd figured out that authority and power do not need to be physically present for it to function. You understand that? So I think he'd figured out that I don't need Caesar to be in my home for me to do what Caesar tells me to do. I don't need to be present for my staff to do what I tell them to do. I send them on my behalf, and when they get to where they're going, it's as good as me being there in the minds of the people that are taking my commands. I think his insight to authority gave him an insight to supernatural things that the church, as we just found, didn't even have. It gave him this centurion factor of kind of faith. Because here's what amazed Jesus. Jesus is on his way to the man's house, and then the second delegation intercepts Jesus with this idea that I just explained to you. Now, what's fascinating here, what's staggering, what's breathtaking, what is amazing, what is awesome, what is phenomenal, all those words would not be exaggerated about what just happened, is that every single miracle Jesus had done until this point, he had never not been physically present. Every miracle till now that we knew about, Jesus had always been physically present in the room or on the street in the same space as the person, laying a hand on them or them touching him. There was nothing, there was no precedent for him not being there. This had not been heard of. No one even knew that this was possible until the centurion came up with an idea, and his factor, his centurion factor, was a kind of faith that gets God to do stuff that apparently no one knew God could do, or God would do, or even God should do for someone like him. So this interception of Jesus doing plan A is business as usual. Nothing wrong with that. Nothing wrong if this story had ended where Jesus went to the man's house, laid hands on the sick servant, and the servant got healed. That would have made this still a brilliant story that we could have preached for hundreds of years like we have. We would have taken this passage and used it like any other to inspire people into faith, to inspire people to believe for a miracle. We would have done that. But something different, something off the charts, something beyond the realms of GPS is going on here. This is uncharted territory, which is why the word amazed belongs here. Because what's amazed Jesus isn't just that he's an outsider that's reached for help, but he's amazed Jesus by this suggestion of don't bother coming, just speak the word. When Jesus knew he had never ever done that yet, and no one knew, including the team with him that are with him 24/7, no one knew this was an option. What's scarier still is this, that that Jesus was willing because he'd set off. Jesus was prepared to walk down a road that he did not need to. Rather than say, I don't need to come to your house, I'll just speak a word. Because the only person that knew it was possible to do that was Jesus, and Jesus didn't say anything. How unhelpful is Jesus? Seriously, how unhelpful is God? Because Jesus knew, and you think, wouldn't you, by the way, that in the economy of life, if you had 3 years to get out what was in you, and this is 18 months in, you've got 18 months left or 6 months left of your life before you die on a cross. You don't want to be walking down any roads, do you, that you don't have to? You're on any wasted journeys when your life is on a timer. So Jesus, knowing his life is on a timer, knowing there are many more people to reach, knowing this will take a day of his life, is walking to the man's house. He is at walking speed, walking speed faith to the man's house. And the man fast tracks him with another idea. And Jesus knew he didn't need to go to the man's house, but was going to go anyway. And it bothers me that in our lives and in our churches, it may well be that God all the time is walking down roads with us, doing business as usual, that he does not need to. He'd perhaps rather not. But he will do that. And by the way, he'll do it for decades. Unless some of this emerges in the church again, where we intercept and we interrupt and we hijack business as usual, we come up with an idea that the very sound of it sounds ridiculous. But this is why I believe that there are people destined to join this church that are out there today who do not believe they'd be welcomed here or any church. But because of how they've built their lives and because of what they've done in their lives, it has given them an inside track of understanding and insight and wisdom this church desperately needs. People will join this church who have an understanding effortlessly because of their life, like this man, that itself becomes like an X, a centurion factor, X factor in the ingredients of the cake contribution to this church the day they join. God will send you people, if you have a heart large enough to receive them, God will send you people that from day one, they come with ideas and ways of getting things done that stops you going down the same road in 2017 that you did in 2016. That gives you an idea that you didn't even know was an option. You know, years ago, a friend of mine called Bill, we were down university campus in town talking about reaching the students. And we'd been there for about an hour having a coffee and just getting a feel of the whole area, watching students come and go. And we were going to leave the coffee shop. And as we got up to leave, a bunch of Chinese students came in that had just obviously arrived in the city and sat down at a table all talking to each other, obviously in Chinese. And here's Bill with me. I've known Bill for 15 years, okay? Bill gets up, walks over to these kids and starts speaking to them in fluent freaking Chinese. I was so shocked because how could I not know Bill speaks Chinese? How could you know someone for a decade and you not know they knew something, they could do something that's so... It's so not what you would keep to yourself. I was so shocked, I was upset shocked. You've been upset shocked? It's the upset bit is, how come you didn't tell me that? I of all people should have known this And then I could have encouraged you to go speak Chinese to them because I know you do. But I'm sat there thinking to myself, wouldn't it be great if I spoke Chinese? And you do. When Bill comes outside, I'm waiting for Bill outside. I am so built up into my rant. I'm like, Bill, for crying out loud, I'm building drama here for Bill to know this is not okay. Bill, for crying out loud, I've known you for 15 years. I didn't know. How could I know? I didn't know. You never told me. Bill, why didn't you tell me you speak Chinese? And Bill, as calm as you like, looked at me and said, because you never asked. Because you never asked, why would I? How would I know to ask you that? Of all the things I might ask you, that wouldn't be my top five. Even his answer was so rude, so inconsiderate, so detached from how things work. Why would I ask you that? I tell you that to tell you this. Bill is a metaphor for God. Because God speaks Chinese, but he will not tell you. But he does. God can do stuff, and God knows stuff. And God has ways and means of getting stuff done that he won't tell you about. You could be here this afternoon, you could have walked with God for 30 years and think by now you know him. But if someone sat next to you in this room could get on this stage now and do something that you did not know they could do, juggle, or do stand-up comedy, or recite poetry, or do magic acts, or whatever, or speak a foreign language, or do or know something you thought you knew all about them, and suddenly they do something that shocks you. If that's true of someone that you think you know all about, how much more true do you think this could be of a God that if you lived a million lifetimes, you would never even scratch the surface of what God can do and what God's capable of? So this centurion factor is a game changer, because we have believed all of our Christian lives that God sets the pace for this stuff. That's not true. Jesus didn't suggest this. This leaves room in the church for us to come up with stuff that God will not tell you or suggest to you. But when you come up with it, he's like, I could do that. Example, the sun's standing still. How whacked is that? Of all the possible solutions to Joshua's dilemma, this would not have been in the top three of the counsel to him, of his generals. Because he's in a battle and they're winning and they had the advantage and it's getting dark. And under the cover of darkness, the enemies would have fled and lived to fight another day, and on the conflict goes. But on this particular day, they are so at a tipping point in that advantage over the enemy, but their biggest nemesis, the daylight fading, was going to change the balance of power from where it had come to at that point. So Joshua has a very practical problem, and his fix was to shout for the sun to stand still, or we want more daylight, and that thing is where daylight comes from. So I'm going to tell that thing that gives daylight to give me a bit more daylight so I can get this thing to a place of no return for the enemy. That's his practical problem. Had the day ended with it getting dark and the enemies living to fight another day, we'd have turned the page in our Bibles and thought nothing of it. Many days ended like that, before and since. But on this day, in fact, the book of Joshua sums it up this way, that never before was there a time, never before was there a man, never before was there an occasion when God listened to a man like Joshua about something so fantastic that happened. Never before or since has God listened to a man about planetary alignment. Because as we all know, the sun doesn't move. So even his prayer is not accurate. Even what he's asking for is not thought through. But God didn't say to him, hey, if you're going to ask me stuff, get your science right. God understood what he wants is more daylight. His way of saying that, your way of saying it, may make no sense to those that hear it. It may not be accurate or thought through or careful or forensic or polite or nice or acceptable or kind. The way you ask for it may not fit in with, you know, the polite religious people. But he just said, son, stand still. And it seems to me, because now we have a few thousand years hindsight, it seems to me, to sum it up briefly, that God went, boom, high five, I could do that. And did it. Well, if God knew he could do it, why didn't he offer it or suggest it? Joshua, I can see your problem. I understand the dilemma. I know you're panicking. Hey, I'm going to help you out today because I am God, omnipotent, omniscient. I tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to make the sun stand still. God knew he could do that. Jesus knows he didn't need to go to the man's house, but he didn't say anything. He spoke Chinese when Chinese is most needed, and he didn't say anything. What this means for us all is that God is holding out on us. Kind of thing. He looks at us in our dilemmas and our trials and our struggles, and he, like you would as a parent, watching your kids struggling to tie their shoes or put on their clothes or brush their teeth. And every parent in this room knows that the last thing you want to do often is step in and help. Because you know that without that struggle and without figuring it out themselves, there comes a point in life where doing it for them is the last thing in the world you should do. And I think God looks at the church and thinks, I have helped you out for 2,000 years. I've done it all for you. And I want you to know, and I'm fascinated by this interesting scripture in John chapter 21, where he's in the upper room with the disciples. And John writes a phrase that is irritating and frustrating, because John says this: Jesus did many miraculous signs in that upper room. Then John writes this: but we were prohibited and forbidden from recording them, which are not recorded in this book. Hang on a minute. So Jesus is doing many miraculous signs, not one or two, many. Here's what I do know. Here's what we do know. These were not normal miracles, because there's nobody in this room needs healing or saving or raising from the dead or demons. So all those miracles of divine intervention are not these. Whatever these are what I would call miracles of affirmation and miracles of confirmation that deepened conviction in who they were dealing with, knowing he's about to check out and send the Holy Spirit. I don't know what he was doing. Did he appear and disappear? Did he make them do that? Did fire appear and disappear? Did angels enter the room and disappear? Did he do something to each one in turn that was so forensically bespoke to their particular struggles, their particular personalities? Did he do something so forensic towards each of their lives as like a personal miracle that would push them over the edge forever in their willingness to go to the wall, which they all eventually did for him? I don't know what these were, but this Jesus in John, this Jesus is what I call the undiscovered Jesus. Because we don't know what went on. But what went on may be the very thing you need, but you don't know what to call it. So this kind of scripture that we just read is so enticing. It draws us in and yet does not give us a list of what to call it. It is these many miraculous signs, but they're not recorded here. Jesus said, no, you're going to see this stuff, but I prohibit you from recording it. Right. Why? Because had he recorded it, we'd have franchised it by now. We'd have tried to build churches on it. We'd have tried to label it and name it and own it and make it ours. That's why these scriptures that we are referring to, of the sun stand still, or who knew sick people could be healed in a shadow. How crazy is that? Never mind, speak the word. We've just got over that bit. Now we're into shadow healings. People being healed in a shadow was not God's idea. Though God knew it was possible, he didn't suggest it to all the people who were not physically able to get to the meeting. Some people are so sick they can't get to the miracle service. What do they do? What's left for them? They came up with an idea like desperate people only can. That because that's not an option to us, we will create our own option. We will go and put ourselves in advance of Peter arriving and walking by. We were going to put ourselves in the space where every day he walks by, and when the sun hits him, his shadow is long, and when his shadow goes past us, we're going to get a miracle in Peter's shadow. We're not going to ask Peter. We're not going to tell Peter. Peter knows nothing about it. They're just borrowing his shadow. They just decided, we're going to get healed in Peter's shadow. And you know what God did? God went, high five, I can do that. I can heal you in a shadow. Well, then why didn't you tell us? Because you can only find it out with this kind of audacious, out-the-box, crazy, ridiculous, naive, who do you think you are, kind of faith, really. That's how you get the shadow healing stuff, I guess. We could go on because this centurion factor is completely empowering of people to interrupt divinity. To say, God, I know you were going to do this, but hey, instead, will you do that? Some of you have no theology for what I just said. You have no theology for telling God what to do. When Jesus is going to feed the 5,000, we have the version in each gospel, but John's is the most fascinating. Because John says that Jesus, knowing what he was going to do, turned to the team and said, hey guys, any ideas? Literally. What do you mean, any ideas? What? I mean, if they'd have asked him any ideas for healing a sick person, they'd seen that. So could have had ideas. But this is the first time this has ever happened. Feeding a multitude on the spot spontaneously, it's unfair to ask them any ideas about that. Because there's no precedent for that yet. This is the first time they've ever... And yet Jesus, still knowing that they've got nothing in their reference points at all, to answer that question, says to them, any ideas? Where will we buy bread to feed so many people? And Philip, who was the logistics man, the accountant, the details man, said, Jesus, I'm your man. I figured it out. Boom, 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 calculator. 8 months' wages, hello. 8 months' wages probably wouldn't even cover this crowd in terms of food. I know that's what you want to know, Jesus. I'm the logistics guy. I'm on it. So great idea. If we're going to do this, it needs a lot of planning, a lot of money. Let's come back in 6 months. We'll try it then. Leave it to me. We'll pull it off, but we need some time. I guess it's behind Philip's 8 months' wages, Jesus. And then Andrew, who is finding a little bit of this, says, hey, Jesus, and I guess this may have been his tone. There's a little kid here with the lunch. Bit of bread, few fish. And then Andrew says this as if he's so embarrassed to have just said it. He said, but, you know, how will so little go amongst so many? You know, I know it's too little for what you're needing. And almost like puts a disqualifier in it that I'm embarrassed to have said it. In case that was stupid, forget I just said it. And so he puts a rider in it to say, but this can't even possibly cover the first person in line, never mind the thousands that we can't see the end of the crowd. So Jesus looks at Andrew, and I think he must have gone, high five. Let's try that. Because here's the thing. Jesus had in mind what he was going to do, but we don't know what that was. Because feeding the 5,000 with the boys' lunch was not Jesus' idea. Wasn't his idea. So what idea did Jesus have? We'll never know. Because Andrew came up with an idea, and Jesus went, we can do that. I wondered if anybody would have an idea. The logistics man just told me what can't be done. And logistics people are awesome as long as their logistics are attached to a can-do mentality. If their logistics are tied to, here's why we can't do it, they're a nightmare. And I've had them on my staff over 30 years, different ones. And I thought, you are not in the room next week because you are a dream killer. But when logistics and detailed people that are amazing, when it's in a solution-oriented mentality, they're phenomenal. Let's get the band back up here. Gives people hope we finish when we say that. So people love the band because the band are like, thank God it's done. We're over. We'll be out of here before midnight. So this is really throwing this out to you all, because I promise you, 2017 will look very similar to 2016. And 2018 will look very similar to 2017. And on it goes, because what changes the landscape, what creates spikes in the flat graph with occasional ripples in it, what changes how things are, what changes business as usual, is nothing God does. If you'd agree with me that God's the same in every generation, that his word and his power and his purpose is the same in every generation, if you'd agree with that, then you tell me, you explain to me, how come then in every generation God doesn't do the same thing? How come there's spikes in church history where something incredible happens? Are you telling me on that particular watch, for those particular people, God decided to be different? No. The only thing that can explain these spikes in church history of an unusual move of God, the only thing that explains that is not God. You can't explain that by looking at things that don't change. You can only explain something random by something else random that happened that triggered it. I think my name for it is this. It is a centurion factor faith that happened in someone personally or corporately. Someone came up with something that got God to speak Chinese. And around that Chinese speaking of God, a game-changing thing happens in a life, in a church, in a city, in a nation. And if you study church history, at the core of every spike is a person. Our people. And something they came up with, like we just read, something they came up with became the game changer in church history. That is still on the table for all of us. If we can uncouple from business as usual and start experimenting a little bit with this, maybe you'll get God to speak Chinese for you this year. And our towns and cities need that aspect of Him to come back in and through our churches. Let's stand together. Come on, time's gone. Hope you learned something today. Glad you came. Well, Father, we love you. We feel we stand every single day on the threshold of new opportunities, new ideas, new discoveries about the undiscovered you that is still fathomless and bottomless. such an immense ocean of undiscoverables about you that we are fascinated by afresh today. And I pray for the emergence and for the more regular occurrence of a centurion factor stepping up by us to get you to do something no one knew you would or could or even should do in and through our lives and churches in the coming months and years, in Jesus' name. Come on, last few minutes of this service. If you're here and today you have never given your life to Christ, and perhaps you weren't ready, or you did that once but it didn't really mean anything to you because you did it for wrong reasons, keep someone else happy, keep someone off your back, feel to fit in by doing that. It doesn't matter. What matters today is that you know right here, this is your time and your turn and your moment to get right with God, to say, God, I'm plugging in today. I really want this. I don't want religion, but I would love a relationship with you that's vibrant and real. And today, this is my time, my moment. Forget who you came with. Forget what anybody thinks about what you do next. This perhaps is your centurion factor faith moment to step outside your comfort zone and say yes to a God who said yes to you 2,000 years ago. Come on, while eyes are closed all across the room, if that's you this morning, will you just put your hand up where you are? When I've seen your hand, you can take it down. Your hand's going to be saying, that's absolutely me today, and I'm not going to miss this moment. Come all across the room. Anybody we can help and reach today, just put your hand up high till I can see it. Then you can take your hand. I'm going to bring you forward or embarrass anyone. If we could lift a hand for you, we certainly would, but we can't. It's between you and God. Come on, someone over here. Come on, anyone else, just pop your hand up high. Then you can take it down. Anyone we're missing. Fantastic. Everybody look at me. Let me just say, and I said this to churches all around the world, I'm not trying to change how you guys do things. But you know what? It's important for us to say to you, because we are servant leaders. So we're here to make this easy for you as best as we can. If lifting a hand doesn't suit you, that's great. That's not the only way to come to Christ. We don't care how people come to Christ. We care that you do, and we care that we don't get in the way of you doing that. So if you didn't lift a hand, don't think I can't come back here again because I didn't keep my end of the deal. I've let my friends down. Can I come back next week and not lift my hand again? Absolutely. If you're still figuring it out, checking us out, checking God out, great. Come as much as you like. We don't care whether you lift your hand or not, as long as you don't care if we ask you to. If you're not offended that we ask you, we're not offended that you don't. So it's a win-win. But if you want to talk to someone or respond in some more private way, lifting a hand wouldn't suit me. It would terrify me. I'm too introvert for that. I would like to do it more quietly with someone I know that I can feel more comfortable with. And I think one of the marks of healthy churches isn't how many hands in a service, but how many people come to Christ outside of a service. And then we just celebrate that on Sundays, and their hands are the icing on the cake, but not the cake themselves. Don't ever be overdefined by hands in a service. We can get obsessed with that. We start to try and grow the church and forget it's about growing people. And our dashboard of health gets a bit mixed up. So however you want to come to Christ, we don't care. As long as we can help that happen and not get in the way, that's what matters most to us. You know, I built a church of thousands in a place where people don't go to church. I had to give people that deal for decades, or they would never have come to Christ if it's just on my terms on what makes us look good by hands in a service. To let that go years ago, to serve what's best for you. Love you guys. Thanks for your welcome.
Thanks for listening. To find out more about our pastors, team, and what we do at C3 Church San Diego, go to c3sandiego.com.